This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And so another week rolls around, the nights already getting noticeably shorter. A big thank you to those of you who've sent in suggestions via all sorts of routes, Twitter and comments pages and emails regarding possible subjects for future episodes. We're hoping to implement as many of those as we can. Keep them coming. Some really excellent suggestions are coming in. I need to respond in particular to one listener who suggests that I've been bad-mouthing Austerly. Oh boy, really? Not knowingly, I must say. I would like to issue a formal apology to Austerly for any perceived slight, and I'm hoping we're going to get along there and redress that imbalance at some point pretty soon. We're heading south of the river this week, only just, mind you. We've nearly been to London Bridge Station before. We've certainly talked about it from the outside. We're onto the platform this week. I'm barely touching the subject of the massive renovation going on there, and instead focusing on one man and his tights. It's Friday, the 15th of August, 2014. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. This is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey, baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.
Well, hello, hello. It's a hot day and I'm having a day of it. Actually, this is a peculiar start to a recording, even by the standards of this podcast. So I gather that I'm here at London Bridge Station, first of all, to experience a platform that doesn't exist. I've just found that out while sitting in an office that I've discovered is due to be knocked down, and I'm here to talk about tights. I've no idea. I mean, genuinely. With me is John McKinnon. He is a producer and canvas stretcher, which only has a fourth dimension to this increasingly insoluble problem. Hi, John.
Hello.
In every sense, what am I doing here?
You're here because the company which I founded a few years ago is called Platform 7, and we do abstract art events in public spaces, and there's always wonderful people who work in big organisations who allow people like me onto their premises to do wonderful things.
Am I any clearer at this point? Yes, slightly, maybe. We were going to have a qualified pianist here, and I don't see how that fits in with anything either. I'd like to describe John to you, listener. John is a gentleman wearing a hat. We are in an otherwise hat-free zone. London Bridge Station, lots of people wearing the white shirts and the name cards on ribbons around the neck thing, but people looking very serious. It's late on a hot day, so everybody's looking slightly haggard. Into the middle of this, with a spring in his step, is John, cutting a very different sort of stride than everybody else. So, first of all, brief. We're going to dance around these announcements, by the way. We're experiencing disturbances to our services as well. You know, it's going to be like this through the whole podcast. In some ways, I'd like a shorter announcement, like, you know, fire, or just for brevity's sake. And we've had a fantastic introduction from Richard Emmons. He's the station interface manager, which I guess is something a bit like public relations. But he's been talking to us about the history of Platform 7, and it's notable that he and Dennis Kirk, the station manager, very approachable people.
Yeah, very approachable. I mean, the reason what's brought us here is the company's called Platform 7, and so basically I owned a cafe bar back in New Cross and Catford and Broccoli, and called Moonboat Jake's, which was very popular for 11 years. And a lot of people from Goldsmiths, from Larburn, from Camberwell, from the art schools, the RCA, etc., used to frequent it. This was way before Starbucks. I started thinking about it in the 90s. Opened in 97, and then went on to 2008-09. And then, and basically what I noticed was a lot of artists doing lots of really interesting stuff. We used to have live performances. I built a theatre, an outdoor theatre. Hundreds of gigs over the years, thousands actually, and it was all in the abstract. Everyone was doing abstract stuff, but what was really interesting was there was people producing great stuff, and yet there was no funding, there was no help, and no one was really sorting out. Yeah, no, they was having their work stolen. They'd do something for 12 years, and then suddenly it'd appear in some stage somewhere, and they would get no recognition, and then you'd see, you know, these broken artists quite often, and it was quite depressing sometimes.
Do you mean actual pieces of their work were being nicked off them?
Yeah. It was people working on the very periphery of the arts are doing some really interesting stuff. A lot of the stuff you see which becomes popular 10, 15 years later started off in some abstract way, someone sort of in some little bar downstairs. I mean, punk. Yeah, you know, I mean, this stuff, but I used to see it on, and it became quite regular basis, you know, this stuff. And my original intention was to open a little chain of cafes and create a venue for sort of abstract performances. That's my real interest, is performance. And there was no way I could afford it. So I thought, I've run these little cafes, they all make a little bit of profit, enough to cover the, you know, the rent, and enough to make some profit. And then I could put that profit into making this space, and that would work. Of course, that's not the reality, because running bars and cafes and other theatres is actually bloody hard work, as anyone who works in it knows. And in this city, it's really hard, you know, like because the rents are high and everything is very expensive. And at the time, before Starbucks, nobody knew what a coffee, you know, an espresso was. Well, not nobody, but a lot of people would say, "What's an espresso? What's a cappuccino?" So you'd
go for a cup of coffee.
You'd go for a cup of coffee, and to be honest, landlords and banks thought I was completely bonkers. And even in 1998-99, people were laughing at me, saying this would never catch on. So then, you know, I don't know what they are saying now. So when I grew out of that sort of thing, I realised this is never going to work. I actually wanted just to do the events. That's what I really want. That's where my passion was. So near the end of the Moonbows period, we was having some dinners, chatting to quite a lot of the artists, people. A network had built up around the cafe bars. And one night at dinner, the wonderful Julian Jacobson, who's a professor of piano at the Royal College of Music, and if you've heard him, he's an amazing man. He, over this dinner, he just said, "Well, what about Platform 7? Because I was asking the question, I want to look at how do people see things they see every day, but they don't notice? You know, how can you notice something which you no longer notice?" And I think in the West, personally, I think, you know, everyone's forgotten how to switch on a tap. You know, that how important, you know, this thing in the morning that you switch on this tap and can drink water. You know, and what's going on at the moment, like in Gaza, that, you know, people don't have access to water, you know, in Syria. You know, and never mind in places in Africa where there is no water and you have to walk 2 miles.
And well, you're talking about taking things for granted, but not just that, by the sounds of it. It's sort of an increased awareness.
Yeah, our society, the way we work, capitalism as it sits, constructs us to sort of, we want the next thing, and we forget about the last thing, you know, like, and we forget about the things which are, water's no longer seen as important until it goes off, and then everyone, yeah, you know, it's on the top end of the news. But when I'm talking about water, just because it's an example, but we, you know, the fact we've got trains in and out of this station, the fact that we've got NHS, you know, all the, you know, these are bigger things as well, you know, but the clothes, we can go and buy stuff. Even if you're the poorest person in this country, that you're going to be very unlucky to starve here, because there's always be someone to look after you. But we're almost not being noticed anymore.
Was there something in particular, like an event or something, that made you suddenly remember that?
Well, from 16, I left school at 16, and I found myself a job in advertising, and I ended up in some of the biggest ad agencies in the world, which are now the biggest ad agencies in the world. But I mean, I didn't realise how cool they were at the time. I just worked there, and it was great. It was BBH, Bartle Bogle Hegarty, GGT, Gold News Trot. These are 20 people, 30 people, 50 people agencies, which then grew and now are thousands and thousands of people around the world. And I gave that up when I was 26, 25, to go travelling. And I went around the world, and I just backpacked for over a year and a half, or almost a year and a half, sorry. And I went through India and Southeast Asia, and I'd go into slum areas and just chat to people, and in, you know, the Middle East, and just chat to people and just sit down. And my dad was always, when he was alive, was always very, you know, when he was children, to be very respectful to people who are down the street, you know, be very respectful to, you know, people who are worse off than yourself, you don't know. And we, and to be honest, we didn't come from much, to be honest. We lived in a council flat in Peckham. So, and it was always that kind of giving, and there was a big community. People looked after each other very much. And so that all fed into this. And when the cafes came, when I came to sort of, I decided I'm going to make these cafes, this is when I was back in London. It was really important to have, to try and make it working so that everyone could use it. And I think that was the attraction, and that's what attracted the artists, because a lot of the artists are skint. Yeah, and this isn't some myth, this is true. You know, people are absolutely skint. And yet they work in, and when they do have money, they invest it into, you know, into something, a project, into their, you know, a new pair of dance shoes or whatever. Not everyone, no, it's not all artists are skint, but a lot of people are. So this all, so getting back to the point of Platform 7, which I've gone off, this is unlikely to go off a tangent, and I wanted to find a name which was about this sort of noticing things. And then when Julian said Platform 7, nobody notices it's not there, you know, like, because there's 16 platforms here, and true enough, ever since, everyone you ask, nobody ever said, everyone goes, really?
Well, there, you say there's no Platform 7. There sort of is.
You're very right. You're very right, there is a Platform 7. But, I mean, you wouldn't want to try and get on a train.
No, you'd have to scale a wall, for one thing. Because all of the signs, they say Platforms 1 to 6 this way, and platforms 8 to 16 the other way. And then there's a vacancy.
Yes, there's a big vacancy, which was because, apparently, we've just found out, is because when they lengthened in 1993, platforms 1 to 6, there wasn't a way into platform 7, so it will be cut off. And so the only way they had to do it was close platform 7.
Yes, they had a blocked throat.
A blocked throat.
Doesn't sound good, does it?
No. So that was the reason, and why was the cause confusion? They kept the numbers the same and just removed platform 7.
So now, let me get this straight. This platform 7 business, the suggestion was what exactly? Merely the name, or to try and utilise this platform 7 in some way?
Certainly that's about the name, i.e. because of it was a long way into the dinner, and there was quite a few of us sitting there, and a lot of wine had already been consumed, and it was that bang, that was the name. So that slowly worked through, and the idea of Platform 7 was to create abstract events to see whether any of this was rubbish or whether it was true.
Does this mean there were lots of other interesting but not so good suggestions for what you should call your company?
There was a lot of, it was a difficult one because people sort of knew what I was talking about, because if you've seen Moonbows, you know how abstract in a way that was, because it was a business. That was the intention was to make profit. Not you made very much profit, to be honest. Well, not that I made very much profit, but even that had a profit for another reason. You know, like, so it was about this more circular way of thinking about and being more inclusive rather than exclusive. But even that, even when it's cheap, it's still exclusive for a lot of people. But the name, once the name caught on, then the point was to then try and work out whether this was still rubbish, you know, whether people do actually just notice everything and people are much more aware, or are we completely caught up in our own worlds to the point that we no longer really empathise broader. When I'm saying, I'm being really, you know, broad brush here. I'm not talking about anyone or everyone. I'm sort of, it's more ephemeral, shall we say. So Platform 7 sort of covered it. So then the idea was to do some events. So I did some events in cemeteries, exploring war and conflict. Come back to that in a sec. And then we did, and that was to see whether the artists would, would come along for the ride. Then it was to see whether an audience would come to the fence, then what would happen? Would the audience feed back to us? And if they did feedback, what would the feedback be? And how did that feed into the new art? And how would that then, and would it stand up academically, which is what I've been doing the last couple of years, just seeing whether it stands up academically before moving on to something completely different. So
in a way, this sounds like a man discovering the wheel.
That would be a hell of a claim, wouldn't it? Well, that was last Thursday I discovered the wheel. Yes, in a way, it's a research. It's been researched. I mean, it started in 2009. I mean, but the thinking's been going back to, you know, the beginnings of the 2000s. And all I've got now at the moment is a lot of stuff written down, which lots of people use as research. And there's a lot of academics been using it as for papers. So there's been a couple of published in the last few weeks, actually. And it's sort of, and the idea is to try and be open and just allow things to develop and allow things to happen. And you know, it's not easy, but I'm always surprised, but I'm always happily surprised, as you've just witnessed this afternoon, that you're in a major station in London under a huge reconstruction, and which is another reason I wanted to come here, with the Shard above us. And it draws into the whole subject matter, which is like regeneration. It's mainly around social issues, so regeneration, displacement, war, conflict, the environment, and the way we think about the environment, because they're all interconnected.
Well, they are, and I'm going to have to disentangle them a little bit, or to take particular slices out, so, in order to find a path into what we're talking about here. So I'm going to try and be fairly specific, and there's a couple of bits I want to pick up from what you've mentioned. The performance of the cemetery is particularly tantalising, and I'm keen to know how you handle audience there. But let's stay with Platform 7. We've got helicopters getting in on the game as well. Let's stay close to Platform 7. What's the what's this tight ball thing? Because this is the most peculiar facet of my brief for today. Tights as in underwear, is that what we're talking about?
If you want to class it as underwear, that's your prerogative.
Well, I don't think that's the most controversial part of this. You're doing a public tights performance.
Well, the tights ball, or the tights, it's the tights, www.tightsball.co.uk, is a project from Platform 7. So what happened with that, basically we have been collecting tights around Lewisham last year, and then Camden Council have just commissioned it.
No, you don't. You've been collecting tights.
Yeah, we've been collecting tights and stories, women's tights and women's stories. But
yes, how is the question?
With bins, which... So Lenka Horakova and Anna Kompinets are two art conceptual artists who go under the name of Eclaria. And basically what we were discussing is the politics of women's tights. Anna created this amazing tights dress, or a dress out of tights. Now, Anna and Lenka always reuse everything. And Anna makes jewellery out of... Anna Kompinets makes jewellery out of old bottle tops and... basically anything you give her, she can make something out of. And she's been doing it a long time, and it's really interesting. Her work has really been developing a long time. But they've, I mean, when I say long time, Anna's from Russia and Lenka was from Czech Republic. They were recycling in communism time. So Lewisham Council approached us after a previous project in 2012, which I need to just briefly go back to, which was called Tapescape. And that was in an old tapescape, that was in an old Blockbuster in Catford, which was shut down because of the riots. And wanted to explore the politics of video cassette. So Kai Clear, who's a great videographer, came up with the idea of the name Tapescape with Lurker, another Platform 7 stalwart. And what happened there was that it was quite abstract. People started to come in, started to find out about videotape. We had a video amnesty. 2,500 videos got returned for recycling, which was nearly a ton. And then what happened, one of the artworks was very, had tape coming out of it. It was a little river of tape, a little stream of tape. And these two young girls really loved it. And that set off a whole conversation which blew our minds, actually. And then Paul Halliday, the artist, who's a photographer at Goldsmiths, who teaches photography at Goldsmiths and Urban Studies, it was his work. And basically, we, with the permission of Lewisham Council and Repic, gave us some funding as well, is we created this giant and deluge of tape, videotape, which people of Catford saw build up over the period of weeks. It ended up being 25 metres long or 20 metres long, and it was amazing, and people were like really freaked out, and you'd get audiences of 20, 30 people. And we did things like we explored the riots. We had a riot in the shop, an actual riot. We explored body image, Jane Fonda workouts. It was about the way women are viewed, way technology, obsolescence. So that, it was so successful, hundreds and hundreds of people came to it, and people were talking about it all over Catford and further afield. Lewisham said, have you got anything on textiles? So I said, well, Anna's got this tights ball. We want to do this project around tights, the politics of tights, because they're quite innocuous. Nobody, you know, they're so small. What possible damage can they do, you know, to the environment and etc.? And Lenken wanted to get more into the politics of the way women perceive themselves through dress. And so the council said, OK, let's go with this, because they had their they were starting textile recycling in the bins. The project went really well. Hundreds of women gave us stories, and we had performances in the street. So Lenka and Anna and a few of the other guys were on their hands and knees washing tights in the street in the middle of Catford, and then hanging them up. And so they actually had a public tights wash.
And what about these stories? How do they fit into this?
Well, what's your story about tights? And then what you end up getting is like, everyone says the same thing. I don't have a story about tights. And then, well, except, and then they give you a story. And some of these stories are very funny, amusing, and some of them are quite sad. Why people wear them, why people don't wear them.
Oh, can you remember any examples?
Well, if you wear tights in Moscow, if you don't wear tights in Moscow, you're seen as a woman of the night, shall we say. If you wear tights in Nigeria, you're seen as a woman of the night. So what does a Nigerian and a woman from Moscow think of each other when they see each other walking past each other in the street, you know, at night, you know? And it's this kind of, because the cultural conditioning for one area, one country, is different to a cultural conditioning of another.
Well, and across the genders as well, because I can't readily think of an item of clothing that would suggest a man is a man of the night.
So a beautiful story from one woman saying that she was freaked out by her father for a few days, because every morning she woke up one morning to see him putting on his mum's tights, her mum's tights. And she was looking at this woman, and she was like, and after the third night, she kept sneaking down to see, and he was doing it every morning. And it turned out he was a roofer on one of the big towers going up in the centre of London. And the tights kept him warm, and all the roofers wear tights, and all the guys wear tights on the railways, apparently. A lot of the guys wear tights because it's a really good way of keeping warm.
Yeah, I must say, I know a couple of cyclists who wear tights underneath their leggings. Yeah.
There you go. And then you build up a bigger picture, a wider picture of why people buy them, why people consume them, why people waste them. And it's the waste which we were really interested in, the way people just throw them away. But it was also that whole, it feeds into the whole consumerist society that we live in, and it goes back to what I was saying about water being, you know, waste. You know, you forget how easy it is to get hold of these things, but actually there's a process behind it, and there's a process after it. So you get one pair of tights and you just use them once, and then they end up in the drawer, they end up in landfill. And we worked out if we get one pair of this ball at the moment, I bought you a ball, I'm now going to hand you a ball, but this is one ball from Camden. This is from the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama, who have been collecting tights.
Let's describe this. I don't know what I was expecting, but this is, you know, your elastic band ball. This is just under the size, I would say, of a football. And it looks as though it's made out of string, pink, red, green, black, white, extremely tight and solid. I'm tempted to find out whether it bounces, but we're sitting next to a railway line. I'm not sure how safe this is. Yeah, not much is the answer.
No, not much. This weighs 3 kilos, roughly. And this is 112 pairs of tights, this ball. And this is what the average woman who has to wear tights to work will wear it in a year.
What did she say when you decided she was average?
The average woman, yeah. This is only based on people telling roughly how many pairs of tights they wear. So on average, it seems like 2 pairs a week is the average weight. That's how many pairs they buy, not necessarily wear. That's how many pairs they buy I mean, it's a straw poll. It's not nothing. You know, there's no science to that. But so you worked it out. That's right. But if we got one payoff every woman in the city based on the big Lewisham ball, it would be roughly 28 metres high, 28 metres wide, and that would end up in landfill because you can't... Well, you can recycle. You can reuse nylon, but you can't really recycle it. So it either goes to landfill or to the burner, generally. They're a waste product. And that's what's... That's the power of the project. Of the project, because when people see the ball, it's very attractive. It's a product. We call it an anti-product. People immediately get attracted to it. They want to know what it is, especially women. It's and we've proven this now, time over. And Central School, Royal Central School of Speech and Drama, were looking. I was speaking to Platform 7 about a performance of something to take people out of the classroom into the streets, and something which would be something a bit more challenging to just being on a stage in a normal stage environment. And so the tights became a project for them. Because Camden Council were very interested in the project as well, from Lewisham, having heard it, seen it at Lewisham.
From an environmental perspective?
Yeah, from the environmental. So this is actually coming from the environmental, but I mean, it works much better than marketing, I can assure you. It is, and what happens is, so they said, can we do recycling? How would it work? So we took it to the estates and we did interventions in the streets in Camden this last month and a half.
How would one of those work?
Well, we did a tights wash and a cutting and making in Swiss Cottage and in Queen's Crescent Market up near Kensal Green. And basically what happens is people, the performance starts and you just allow people to enter at their own will and people come in. And actually in Camden, maybe because there was a lot more, because students were there as well, there were so many more people. We literally, on Swiss Cottage, we had 120 stories and they range from, you know, we're building up quite a big record of consumption generally, but also about waste. And also one of the things that we've worked out is the bins don't work. Those don't work. Recycling bins don't really work. So people just don't notice them, basically. They notice them, but they're very they're another product. So if you look at a recycle bin, you look at, there's a poster behind us of no cycling here on the platform. There's not really much difference in the design, and there's nothing to really make you differentiate a bin, a tights bin, or a waste bin, a recycle bin, from a normal bin. Really, to be honest, it might be green, you know, but even that's been manipulated, etc.
This is a bit of laziness on our part, though, isn't it, as the consumer and the post-consuming process?
Yeah, and we can be lazy because at the moment we have money and we have access and we have a lot of poverty in the Far East and other parts and probably Africa. Well, in, you know, lots of people probably end up in big factories in Africa like they were in, you know, in Southeast Asia for many years and making things for virtually nothing. There's an interesting book by Caroline Knowles at Goldsmiths who wrote called Flip Flops. Which is about the life of a flip-flop as it travels from its oil in Kuwait into flip-flops and into the shops. And, you know, people are working for 20, 30 pence an hour, dollar an hour, you know, or dollar a day, you know. And that's how we can buy a £2 pair of flip-flops we can wear once. And the throwaway. You know, I was really pleased to be at Latitude this weekend to see that a lot of the tents were packed up. Well, in the guest area where I was, a lot of people packed up their tents. 3 years ago, I remember being at Latitude with just despair on the Monday morning, looking at just a whole field of tents which people had just left behind. You know, and these just go into a landfill or they go to a burner, whatever they do in Suffolk, I don't know. And this just gets wasted. And, you know, so this cycle is unsustainable. I mean, you don't need to be a scientist to know this is unsustainable.
Well, sure, but I wonder what effect you're hoping your interventions then will have.
Well, last week we were invited to present to all the councils in London. So they had this. There's a big senior meeting, and there was a lot of bodies there as well from London. And these people work in waste. One good thing I can't imagine councils get much praise. But I must admit, they were passionate about their subject of waste. And London's a particularly difficult listening in on the meeting, because we were just sitting for most of it in the meeting, just hearing what they had to say amongst themselves. And London has got a particular problem because of its diversity, the amount of languages, the amount of transients, the flats, the way the streets are. This creates a real problem for recycling and the way we think about recycling. So we presented the tights ball, and we presented the bins, and we explained and the tapescape, and we explained what has happened, and they could see it. I said, you just look at the blogs, you can read how people are thinking about this, you can see what people are persuading. And what happens is they see the ball, they laugh, they think it's funny, they think it's weird, or they think it's great, whatever the thing. Then they ask a question, and then a conversation starts. And within that conversation, you get a whole host of information back about recycling and about consumption.
But have I not understood you correctly that these things can't really be recycled?
Yes, they can be recycled. So you can make them into other things, you can strip them back, but the cost of stripping it back, most textiles, I mean, there's a textiles business now, recycled textiles. I mean, when I had my first cafe, I built the whole thing, the furniture and everything, from £200 worth of furniture.
And you recycled all your coffee, didn't you?
Yeah, recycled. Well, actually, even the coffee used to have someone come and collect it. I mean, it was a lot more difficult to recycle. It was the point isn't about recycling. The point is about consumption. Because it's the way we consume. I mean, that's where the problem lies. Because every time you use something, even if it has to be recycled, it has still got to be transported somewhere, it's still got to be melted down, it's still got to be repurposed, What Anna's fantastic at, particularly, Anna Compinetto, who I mentioned earlier, what she's brilliant at is like thinking about how to reuse something. So we've had things like, oh, let's make this into a Pilates ball, let's make these into weights. And this is what we're looking at with the councils, is to look at ways of... So people do things themselves at home. So they don't put it in the bin in the first place. It just stays at home, but it becomes a doormat.
But surely you're fighting against a big, mindless corporate tide, or actually rather calculating, I suppose, which is against anything other than inbuilt obsolescence, and it's against people being able to make do and mend and patch things up and have things run for a long time. They don't want that, do they?
Precisely. And the tape, going back to Tapescape in Catford, we had a conference with Goldsmiths Symposium there about built-in obsolescence, about that very subject because of the technology. And if you go onto the website, platform7.com website with a hyphen, you will see lots of essays and lots of reports and everything else. And I totally agree with you, but ultimately it depends on your view of how, regardless whether we... The machine cannot keep going. It will keep going through our lifetime. But all the way through history, there's always... People have to constantly run against the machine slightly and challenge what's going on. And you can challenge it. You can protest. You can throw rocks at police officers. And you can do all other kinds of things like that.
Not that we're advocating that.
No, I mean, that's one thing what's happened. And you end up in the situations what are happening right now all across the world at the moment. Or you can be fun and think about things more... holistically, and think a bit more about how can we change things by thinking about it. So going all the way back to the beginning of Platform 7, it's the idea of the little things, and those are the things you see every day, considering that subject matter and just thinking, because if you think about small things, suddenly the rest of the big things speak for themselves.
Well, we're going to be back with John McKinnon in just a moment, thinking about small things, thinking about a big thing as well, which is the station to my rear, which has reached a state of obsolescence in part. It's being renewed and rejuvenated and rebuilt, and we're going to discuss a little bit of that, and also perhaps some piano music as well under discussion.
Londonist Out Loud is available free as a stream at Londonist.com or a weekly download via iTunes. Hit us up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, tweet at Londonist Sound, and check out images of our guests via the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and with me is John McKinnon, and he is Platform 7. That's it. We're next to Platform 7, and he is Platform 7.
I founded Platform 7.
I founded Platform 7, and I've just found Platform 7. we might have to retake that introduction. We're at London Bridge Station and we've been permitted to record on the platform, which I've got to say is quite an unusual thing quite often, and we've talked about this in recent broadcasts. Anybody who is in charge of one of those sort of semi-public, semi-private type arrangements, they really don't want you doing too much in terms of recording photography without lots of paperwork and vetting and so forth. But it struck me that you've got a good relationship with these guys. And have you been thinking about putting on performances on Platform 7, through Platform 7? Is that how you're thinking?
Well, this is the first conversation this last few days with actual London Bridge Station. But we've actually done performances. We've just recently done a performance on, well, Southeastern, the train line, the main train operator through here gave us a train. So we had
a... What do you mean they gave you a train?
They gave us a train so we could use for a performance.
Well, no, hang on. Well, nobody gives people a train.
They gave us a train from Ramsgate to Charing Cross Station, and then Charing Cross very kindly allowed us to perform in the middle of the station a performance for Rest in Place. Most of our most recent events have got their own websites, as well as the Platform 7 website. You can go to www.restinplace.eu, and it's about a World War I nurse. It's a 2.5 year project about a nurse going off to become... a woman going off to become a nurse, apologies. And she went via Charing Cross Station. So we had a performance in the middle of Charing Cross Station. But a few years ago, we were given, on Remembrance Sunday morning, 10, well, as many tube stations as we wanted, actually, and the old Eurostar at Waterloo. The week before, they charged, I don't know, $100,000 to James Bond, and we got it for free, which is really sweet.
I don't want to uncover some personal scandal here, but how are you managing to achieve all of this? It's got to be like blackmail or marrying into various families, or what's going on?
The work stands up. That's basically, the work is really heavily researched. We don't just do, I mean, when I call myself a canvas stretch at the end of the day, it was basically about making space in public spaces for artists to work in. And going back to the very beginning when I was talking about the cafe, the artists, you know, who come and go, and the Platform 7 sort of ethos and ethics are quite singular in many senses. People just want the world to be a better place, and their work is it's quite singular what they do. So they're not filmmakers and painters and, you know, trapeze artists. They're actually, they're a pianist, you know, that's what they do. They just do one, and then they're very passionate, and they've got a very strong ethical approach to their work and society and community. And so, going back to Julian Jacobson, I mean, I opened an old cafe in Margate many years ago. Greasy Fat, nothing been on that shop for 7 years. I said to Julian, before I opened, Julian, would you mind coming down and playing something? He came down and did a gig. We just wrote on the window there'd be a gig here tonight, and 14-odd people from local. You know, this is down in one of the most deprived areas in the country, in Cliftonville, which is a bit better now, but this is just as the Turner opened. It's a different project. But that's the kind of thing people do. You know, they're happy to do stuff. And I think on the other side of the coin, people in, like, Network Rail and Southeastern and London Underground. I mean, London Underground board approved us going on to the Underground on Remembrance Sunday morning. They look at the work, they go, actually, this is quite interesting. And ultimately, I think most people acknowledge that this is unsustainable, even if you're not allowed to say it. And this, we're not saying, as I said to you before, I'm not saying let's rip it all up and start again. Nobody wants to, you know, walk 2 miles to get water, you know. But you've got to also accept that we need to sort of change our behaviour in some way. So it's not about behavioural change, it's just about, through abstract art, the artists are so dedicated or so specific about their work and what they're doing. So the tights ball, or the story about Clarice going off to war, it's about a woman leaving, it's about a woman's journey, you know, a young woman heading off to an unknown place. Even though it's 100 years, it resonates. And the staff, I was told by the management at Network Rail and Southeastern at Charing Cross, the staff were really moved by the thing, and hundreds of people just saw this event taking place in the middle for free, and then it dispersed, and everyone, I've never actually had to give out so many flyers, because we ran out in the end. So many people wanted to know about this event, And this sort of, so each event captures another event. So we, you know, this meeting at the council, this is not because these council meetings, it wasn't because, you know, they want to have a bit of fun. You know, both Camden and Lewisham love the title plan. They've seen what already its effect. The universities, you know, I mean, there's a lot of universities done a lot of work on it. I mean, City and King's and Queen Mary, Goldsmiths. They're interested in how people are thinking about stuff, and you can't. And having come in from an advertising background, these focus groups are rubbish. People just—they're paid to be there. You know, if you're talking about watches, they'll tell you about watches. They tell you about reading the time.
That advertising background, there's been something that's been lurking in the back of my mind and bubbling up and coming to the front, I guess, now, which is a lot of people that I've spoken to, and I used to do an arts-based radio show, purely arts-based radio show before, and a lot of people who would appear on there, I quite often got the impression that there was a bit of box-ticking going on, and I'm not sure whether it was a chicken or an egg situation, but I often felt that people were following up on sort of ethical, societal concerns first and foremost, because that was what would pay the bills, because they would get funding for doing that sort of thing. I don't doubt their sincerity once they'd latched onto an issue, but it did seem to be that way around. And I'm sensing a stronger sense of sincerity from you by far, and I'm detecting that you plunge yourself into the art, and then it's in some ways found its ethical level and its moral level and its utility as well. But I'm wondering whether that reassurance I'm feeling from you is in part because you're better at selling your work, because you come from a salesy art advertising background.
I mean, you can, yeah, of course, this could be possible. I don't think it is. There's a strong ethic and ethos, and money wise, funding is very hard for us to get any money from anyone. Won't play the Arts Council game. Won't just do something for the sake of doing it.
Well, then, what is the? Because you must, in that case, you must sense that same thing. And I get the impression that you're far too nice a person to say so. But you must look at some other artists and think that's just got a bit of a whiff about it. I'm not quite sure of the sincerity there. What is the quality that you identify in yourself and in your process, the process of your company, that means you avoid falling into that trap?
I think it's always been aware of it. I think some stuff is... I think there's sometimes this genuine belief that they're doing something genuinely interesting, but actually... I've written quite a big critique of marketing, advertising, and university education generally, and the which I sent round to several big universities, and I got a very good reaction back from. I was asking them to critique. Everything's critiqued, so we critique each other and the artist and everything. But ultimately, if you're going for the buck, it's, you know, you're going to have to play by the buck's rules. But you can still do stuff. I do think that there is a momentum building. If you've seen abstract, really bad poverty, if you've seen some really, I mean, I've seen some really bad stuff. I've got some of the people who back Platform 7. So there is some people around the world who just sort of, you know, will pay for an event somewhere down in Margate. You know, they don't even live in the country. They just pay, you know, just to cover the cost of being there. But they've been out in war zones, places, awful places, like the Rwandan genocide. And when you sit in a room just having a drink and chatting, and you hear, you know, for years I've known these people, you know, and you hear it firsthand, I wasn't there personally, you can't cope with it. You know, it's really strong, really pain. And if you've got empathy, which most of the people I have got empathy, it's very hard just to lie, really. It's very hard to just... you are who you are. And so I work with people who do what they do, you know, and then there's just a lot of us. But actually, there's a lot of people around. But the problem is there's no forum for them to coalesce around, which isn't somehow political or politicised. So it's very difficult... You want to be part of the political process, but you're not wanting to be, you don't want to enter it. So politicians are never quite sure how to deal with you. People get nervous, but when they see the work, when you actually see the work,
We did a, just for example, did an event called Silent Cacophony last November, which is, so we've done 5 years. And they did tell you about the cemeteries, that you asked. Did 5 years of on Remembrance Day or around Remembrance Day about war and conflict. That was based on Harry Patch dying. And that's what inspired the first event. It was in a cemetery at night, in darkness. Lewisham Council, the only reason they allowed it to happen is because of the cafe bars. And they knew me, and they knew the events that I did, and the kind of stuff. They sort of went, okay, they took a chance on it. This is way before all the, what, this is back in 2009. And you'd be quite surprised how limited public those kind of events were at that time still. You know, those were still off time. Huge response, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Anyway, every year do stuff around war and conflict, how we can see, how we construct our opinion on war and conflict. In 2013, we did one across London, did one in parts of the world, Lebanon, it was in The Hague, and it was artists all over the city doing specific performances around silence and explosions. Because before an explosion, but after an explosion, sorry, a lot of people who survive talk about there was a silence. You couldn't hear a bird tweet. You couldn't hear, you know, it was such a perfect day, as if they knew that it was silent. Generally, you don't notice silence, you know, very rarely, unless you maybe go on holiday. You construct it because you need to construct it. And that's why we construct our lives to sort of to justify what we're doing or whatever we do. So there was a, there was 30-odd events across. I mean, like Duncan Menzies is this amazing bagpipe. Stood on the roundabout of Bow, and would, as the instrument, as the traffic was moving, he'd be playing the bagpipes. When it stopped, he would stop. So people could see the bagpipe, but they couldn't actually hear it. They could only hear it, you know, while they were moving. But, of course, they couldn't hear because it was too noisy. And it was this kind of... It was quite... So people were looking it up and going, this is really odd, but it... It was more about that what had happened in that area, you know, these V2s and V1s and Zeppelins blowing the hell out of people on the ground, which people don't realise why that's all there. So these are the kind of events. And what was really surprising, what was really beautiful last year about that was because of the other 4 years of events, underground and the three in cemeteries, every council rushed it through. They just made sure that the events happened in their area. And there was no audience sort of being... It wasn't being promoted in the sense of come and see this at 11:30 today. La, la, la. It wasn't... It was just posters went up. This would be happening. And if there was one person there and it was pouring out of rain, or 100 people, that didn't make any difference to the artist. So but we had things like an old 30s typewriter typing in St. Bride's, which I think you've interviewed recently in the print room there. And Nancy, who was a professor of poetry at Harvard, typed her poem. She lives in America. So she typed her poem where the bombs went off at the brook in Boston at the marathon. So she typed her poem and it slowly typed out automatically onto this old typewriter with 50 or 60 people watching in wonderment. It's the effect. It's how people then remember that, which then prompts a wider discussion the next day, the next week, the next month. They go, oh, I saw something. And it's about broadening and going to the bigger corporate. The corporates are trying to change. There's people within corporates trying to change. So Network Rail have very kindly allowed access to all their scrap on there, which they're clearing the track sides following all these events and that. So, and got access to a couple of stations. And the idea over the next 2 years is to create some work around... basically London's being forced out. So this is the next thing about displacement, but this is a different kind of displacement, and it's exploring this idea of the corporate, but the people who work in these corporates are as affected by situation as everyone else. And there's the, and what I'm sort of saying is there are the risks that the centre of London becomes a theme park and a playground for the rich, and that no residents will end up being here in 10 years' time, because this tower which we're under right now, the Shard, which is sitting empty, it's not... I'm against it. I'm not for it or against it. But the effect it is having is quite... Yeah, besides sunshine in the train driver's eyes, it's quite immense. And I come from Peckham. You know, you're from North London. You know, friends. And on the poetry circuit... which is often where you hear the first, you often hear what's going on quite often. There is a crying out, you know, people, you know, especially if you're 17, 18, 20, 25, you don't know what to do. You people are panicking. And this panic is beginning to work its way up. You know, most of the staff here apparently don't live anywhere near here. They all have to come in by train. These trains are going to get, they may go in a bigger station, but already St. Pancras is full, apparently. Is that capacity?
You've given us the perfect link that we need. One thing I've been marvelling at as we've been talking, particularly as you've been talking, is the way your brain connects subjects so fluidly and gracefully slides from one to the next without a seam. It's very interesting to hear that process. I tend to need things a little bit more compartmentalised myself.
I hope I don't sound arrogant, because it's not meant to be.
No, not remotely. Well, not to my ear. Certainly, no. It's just interesting hearing what kind of connections you make and trying to guess where those links might be.
They're interlinked. I mean, everything's interlinked. You know, you can't...
I see that that's how you see the world. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you can't... You know, our effect now will have an effect on... I mean, we've already affected the guys here. You know, they've been happy to bring us down. They've had a change of day to change their day. This has had an effect elsewhere and la la la. You know, everything has a connection.
Well, connections is an apposite where we're at London Bridge Station, and there's huge, huge change going on now. And even having been guided around the station and shown a couple of years ago what might be up for grabs, the level of destruction and renovation and reimagination here is far surpasses what I thought was going on.
It's incredible. I'm always sad to see buildings coming down, you know, like an old brickwork, because you lose memory. I mean, that's the big... I mean, I think the biggest worry for Londoners, if mine and people I know, is the rapid change and having things just wiped out, because it can wipe out an entire memory of your working life, your child life, blah, blah, blah. And it's the speed of it.
And you use this station on a very regular basis?
Yeah, I use this station. But ultimately, I still want it to be a nice state. I want, you know, to be able to use it safely and get through it as well as everyone else. But I'm a big fan of transport hubs, and you know, because I think they're important, you know, for a city that's going to move around. And as I said earlier, I'm not looking to, you know, I don't think we should try and stop the world turning. I'm just thinking that we need to turn it maybe in a different direction. But I also think personally there is a big change taking place, and this network rail, this idea of going back to the network rail scrap, is to explore that, using people being forced away from work and back into it, and using the trains, people looking out the windows, people looking out onto the tracks, and knowing that their place of work and their place of a home can't be the same place. And the rate we're going at the moment is not likely to be the same place. And, you know, as you heard earlier, we're going to have four more through platforms here, which means there's going to be 17 trains an hour from Brighton. I mean, that means Brighton's suddenly going to go differently. So this is... But that means if your child is ill and you're in an office in central London, you've still got to get that to Brighton, even if you've got a really fast train. And that idea of, I mean, especially I think for mothers, young mothers, I mean, that's quite a big effect, you know, that might change the way they can, that might become another way of working. You know, they can't work in town anymore because they don't want to be an hour away from there. But they have to be an hour away if they want to work in town, because they can't live any closer. So this is going to affect business eventually, and that then will affect, you know, investment, and that will affect the amount of offices that I empty, which then become vacant, which then loses its... Then theatres can't survive because there's not enough people in the town. And before you know it, you've got a ghost town like you get in a lot of state America. I mean, I was in Taipei, and then you go to their business district, it's just empty. It's just void outside the business times. And do we want that in a city like London, which we pride ourselves and we love? Yeah, if you love it here, which I do, that's what you want. You want this vibrancy.
The consequence of that seems naturally to be that your audience, if you were running, say, evening performances of something in London, could be entirely made up. The audience could be entirely made up of people from out of town, tourists and so forth. Do you find that there's a particular segment of society, internal, external, that warms more readily to what you're creating?
What happens, there's lots of proof to this on the website, you know, if you want to read it, there's a lot, is it's not about getting thousands of people to sort of go, wow, it's not a football game. And the thing about this problem in the arts, this focus on numbers and audience feedback and audience reaction, is just, you know, it's killing a lot of the arts. Because it's not about numbers, it's about how you're affected. So, you know, one piece of, you know, Guernica, I often point to Guernica, you know, it's the effect of Guernica. When Picasso was painting Guernica, I don't know the full history of Guernica, but my impression is he wasn't painting it to try and make a point of, oh, I might be able to sell this to the United Nations and have it up on the wall as a tapestry or something. He was thinking, I want to make a point about what's happened to these people from northern Spain who've just been bombed while they were looking up at, didn't know what these things falling out of the sky were, and didn't understand the concept of that, you know, this horror, you know. And it's about that kind of, and then if you see it and it affects you, then you go and find out about it. And the work, the, you know, the roundabout, you know, Duncan being on a roundabout, or Julian playing the piano in a cemetery, or someone's reading poetry about babies being blown up on the underground at 11 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't to shock people, it's just people don't notice, but when they do notice, they go, that was odd, I don't know why, I think, and then they get engaged, then it opens their mind. And it's about the idea, the abstract art for me personally is sort of, it's different to entertainment. And there's a lot of people doing really good entertainment. In this city, it's full of great entertainment. But a lot of people I work with are doing stuff which is quite subtle.
So you swapped advertising for subliminal advertising?
Yeah, maybe. Well, it's something I struggle with. I don't struggle with. I sort of, it's a conversation that's constantly being had. Because this isn't something, as I said, it's a research project almost. It's an ongoing 6 years in. It's the way we think about the world and the way we think about what we see around us. And what you're hearing from me and what you're hearing from me is the way that has been fed in all those hundreds or thousands of people who have written something or said something. But what you get, I mean, one of the cemeteries, a guy said to me, he was 91, this is in Margate Cemetery, after doing an Up the Line event, run the cemetery around war. And he came up to me at the very end and he said, when I was... I don't know how old he said he was, but in World War II this was. He was in a bunker or in a whatever he was in with all his friends. Got a direct hit. Everyone died except him. Wasn't injured. So he had his entire childhood friendships wiped out in that second. And it was in Remembrance, what's now Remembrance Week. And so he hates Remembrance, personally. He hates that whole thing because it brings back this awful memory. So he came and he said, I'm a complainer. And I came here to complain, basically, so I could hit the council tomorrow. And he just came to shake my hand and he just said, no one has understood my pain until this moment. Tulse Hill, Streatham, Norbury, Thornton Heath, and Selwyn. Those are the names of
platform 15, 4, 16. Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to a CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
A complaint that I might level against the way that artists represent their art sometimes, I don't know whether to call it a complaint or not, I certainly hear other people complain that protesters, artists, for some reason they seem to be wodgeable together in this, are very happy to churn up ideas and to talk about exploring things and so forth. But there's a notable lack of answers or even suggestions, anything concrete in terms of sort of moving forward. And I do sometimes feel that might be a deficiency. It's also the strength of art quite often. But in terms of effecting change, it's a little open-ended. And sometimes you kind of do need an alternative, a flag being waved, or somebody suggesting, well, how about this instead? And I wonder whether art, at the same time as it does allow freedom, maybe sometimes it fails to take a position.
Is it? I don't know if it's for art to take the position, but it opens the conversation and it affects the conversation. In a sense that it allows for an abstract way of thinking about the same thing, because if you've ever dealt with politicians or people who've just been intransigent for the sake of being intransigent, and I'm sure you've been intransigent, I've been intransigent, we've all been intransigent, is that the thinking is very suddenly narrowed. And going back to this kind of work is about opening up a conversation and develops the conversation to allow others maybe a different perspective slightly. But we're at the stage now of this network rail stuff, which I just mentioned, is to create a hub. It's actually to look at this. So I want to sort of go into the city. I'm looking for a building in the city right now. And it's about whether the community, the corporates can become a community. And it's this idea of the system's going to change. It is going to change because it's already changing. We're in bubbles. And as I always say, if you're in the middle of the Roman Empire, you will never know that the Roman Empire is over. You wouldn't know that. And I'm not going to say that the system we're in now will be completely different in our lifetime. But it will be quite radically different by the time if we survive another 40 years or something. It's going to be quite different because it's unsustainable in the system. So working with a great guy called John Wood, who's a professor emeritus at Goldsmiths. He's at the design department. He worked at the one Young British Artist, all that kind of crowd. Young British Artist, all that crowd. But I'm also very sceptical, I'm also very sceptical of that, of a lot of the art, and whether most of it is about themselves or... There's a lot of rubbish art around. There's no doubt about it. I'd like to think that the research and the amount of work that goes in it allows us a little bit more scope to sort of explore, but it's how people are feeding back, and you hear the best results, the best things back from people who aren't experts. And this can come from any direction. It can come from anyone. And the Tights project, you start to hear, as we've been doing this project, and we know we go London-wide and have this inter-borough competition, which is what we're trying to set up. And the idea was then to plonk this big Tights ball on the fourth plinth, as a huge Tights ball, memorial to our consumption. What happens is the children see it, and then children, and it does affect. It does have a trickle down effect if it's strong. People are affected if it's strong, and we've been allowed onto this platform very kindly. As long as we don't do anything silly, which we don't plan to do, maybe we'll do a few performances. It could be a poetry reading for 10 people, but that 10 people get on the train and they're thinking about something different. They see a piece of artwork, they see a sculpture which suddenly affects their way, I'm missing my child, I want to be working closer to my child. They go back to their work and they say, look, why don't we move an office to Brighton, or why don't we do this? The Tights project is actually about that idea of how women are perceived and how women perceive themselves, and how men perceive women, how men perceive Tights, which is quite different generally to how, and it's not what we thought it was either. Most British men, it seems, have no interest in Tights at all, and it's quite an interesting and there's some really funny stories about she wears Tights for me, but I don't actually like them, but I don't want to tell her. She is then saying to him, I only wear Tights for him because he likes me in Tights. And these two guys were married for 20 years, and they were talking to different people, and it turned out that neither of them actually liked Tights, but neither of them actually ever told each other this fact that neither of them liked Tights. So she's been wearing Tights and he's been hating them all these years. And I think that sort of just sums up how we, we can walk around blind for years arguing about stuff. But is there an answer? Yeah, there is an answer. I haven't got it, and I'm not likely to be the person to find it, but I think we are doing our little bit, and I think if everyone's just chips away a little bit and does their little bit, we're in a very privileged place. Being in London, we're very privileged, and we are at risk, in my opinion, of losing it if we don't sort of deal with this, which is a growing crisis. And the thing is, a lot of young people are angry. They feel left out, but they're not angry. They want to smash things up, which is really beautiful. It's different. It's different to being in Peckham, where it's a much gentler anger. they're still angry and they're stressed, and I think we've got to remove that stress.
Well, that discussion of London and what it's for, I suppose, not that I ever come into any interview with a list of questions, but my final question, I think, is what would you do with yourself if you were to be parachuted into onto a desert island by yourself? What would you do?
My worst fear is being in a prison cell. I think the idea of being locked away, if it was a desert island that's outdoors, I'd probably just enjoy, hopefully there'd be some birds there to listen to, and I can listen to their bird song and maybe, you know, get to know them a bit better and get to know the coconuts and understand how coconuts grow, you know.
Does solitude attract you as an idea?
My favourite place in the world is deserts. You know, I do love deserts. I've been to the Outback and Wadi Rum and Rajasthan, and yeah, I love deserts. I enjoy people. I enjoy my, you know, but I'm quite comfortable being on my own. I travelled when I'd been travelling for 2 years almost, or 18 months, whatever it was, on one trip. I was mostly on my own with my rucksack. I just like chatting to people. People say, oh, you know everyone around here. And I was like, no, I don't. I just chat to people around here. And it's something which bothers me a little bit in London, that's been lost a little bit. I don't know if your opinion is the same, but there's not Londoners generally don't fear other London. You know, they're generally happy to have a chat. And Londoners, I always found, are really friendly. and I always say Londoners are friendly. It's people who's not from London who, when people say, oh, Londoners aren't friendly, it's generally people not from London who's moved to London, and then they live in fear of talking to people. But like, yeah, no, I don't know. Maybe I just end up rambling on like I do now.
Talking to the birds. Have you seen this ball?
Someone said Cafe St. Luce is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful music promoter, I think, for South London, who runs Rocklands. If you don't know Rocklands, look up Rocklands, the South London Tourist Board. She's fantastic. And she said something beautiful a couple of weeks ago, which was, why don't the police just have bird song when people get angry? You can't throw rocks when there's bird song, when you're listening to bird song.
On which performance-related note, thank you so much, John McKinnon, for being with us here. A quick reminder of your website.
www.platforms-7.com. The Tights Ball, all of them are their own website, but that's the main website. And then the Tights Ball specifically is www.tightsball.co.uk.
John McKinnon, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
My heart aches for some far off. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to John McKiernan. Thanks to Dennis Kirk and Richard Emmons. Thanks to Mark Barr and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. The station announcers were played by themselves. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.